In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Oh, hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 3 of Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy, which you should know because you probably had to come to the website to access it. Today is the first really official Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy podcast because we're getting into reviews now. Before we had the intro, and then we did sort of like the chase through action film history, and today we're actually going to take movies, cut them open, and pull out all their guts, and dump it on the floor, and then put them back and sew them up, hopefully even better. But because it took me this long to create the podcast, we won't really do one at a time. So this is this summer 2016, action film wrap-up. We're going to talk about almost the dozen movies that came out this summer. And when I say summer, I don't mean the season. I mean the summer movie season. You may or may not know that every year the studios push back the summer movie season. It basically started with Star Wars when that came out in early May. And May is not summer yet. That's, from a scientific standpoint, still spring. So we're not talking about spring, summer. We're talking about summer movies. And let me start by giving you the first most important thing, which you'll be hearing probably at the beginning of every single podcast from here on in, which is a spoiler alert. It's really simple. If you're the kind of person who has an itchy Twitter finger ready, oh, that's great, Twitter finger, I have to remember that, Twitter finger ready to send out a note saying, oh, you spoiled this movie or whatever, I don't care. Don't bother. You can. I'm just going to laugh at you. I don't care. This is a spoiler-full zone. It is not a spoiler-free zone. I'm not planning to spoil these movies. But if I do, oh well. You're just going to have to live with it because I'm talking about the action scenes, and I'm not going to parse my words to protect your delicate, unseeing eyes from, you know, hey, if you don't know Rosebud was a sled, and you don't know that the dead person that the guy saw in The Sixth Sense was Bruce Willis all along, I'm so sorry for you. But I got news for you. I have not seen a movie of this kind ever since the original Omen, the one with Gregory Peck, and Seven, the one with Brad Pitt, without knowing the ending first. I have not seen any movie of that kind because I don't go to the movies to get upset. Pissed off, yes. You'll notice there'll be a lot of being pissed off during this and subsequent autopsies. But not to get upset. Movies for me are a sanctuary. I went there to find heroes and find rationalization and solution to mysteries, not to get my face pushed into it. So I'm not interested in saving you from spoilers. And I, like I say, I find out the spoiler before I'll even go to most movies now, so I can go and simply enjoy them. Anyway, so there's your disclaimer. Mike, we should really come up with like a song or something, or one of our like little rappers just about the spoiler alert. We should work on a spoiler alert song or a spoiler full song. I'm with my buddy Mike Robb, my webmaster and the master of all media. I don't care what they say about Howard Stern. It's you, Mike. Introduce yourself. You're on the mic, Mike.
Well, what would you like me to say? You've already said it all.
There you go. I've already said it all. But we also have another guest.
Yes, we do.
We have a secret little...
Could you wake her up now? Because 3.5 minutes ago, she fell sound asleep.
Now, what'd you say your name was again?
My name is Jen.
Jen what?
Jen Hurler.
What a great name. And you also are going to have a podcast, are you not?
This is true. I'm currently working on an animation history podcast called Animation Complex, which you will be able to find at animationcomplex.com.
Maybe, if she gets it done in time.
Which I will, because I know when this is coming out, and I also want to be ready for New York Comic Con next month.
That's right, and also, hopefully, you'll hear Jen again Definitely we're going to have at least one, if not many.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be many.
Action film podcasts about specifically animation. Because from my point of view, and I mentioned this, I believe, at the in my introductory podcast a couple of weeks ago, that my first real heroes and the first great action heroes that I followed were Popeye and Bugs Bunny. So we'll be talking a lot about that. But now, let us go into our wrap-up, summer wrap-up. So, this year, the summer movie season started May 6th, and it started with, another spoiler alert, what I still consider it the best action movie of the summer, which was Captain America: Civil War. It's directed by the Russo brothers, Anthony Russo and Joe Russo. And it's a great movie to discuss what action movies have mostly become now, because they're no longer the kind of action movies I saw as a kid. You can't compare Captain America: Civil War to say something like Dr. No, because Dr. No, you had a stunt arranger, you had a fight arranger, you had stunt men. Now you don't have, you still have a lot of them, but you have a lot more of something else. And I know some people will say, oh yes, movies are all special effects now, but they're not all special effects now. They're also something which they are calling visual effects, to keep it separate from special effects. And to do an action movie now, you need stunt arranger, fight arranger, stunt men, and an army of special effects and visual effects people. Now, what's the difference? If you check IMDb and look at the credits, you will see that the special effect people are in usually a minimum, while the visual effects people can go on for thousands and thousands of names. So what I think, and you guys can correct me if you know more about this than I do, than what I'm about to say, special effects are essentially physical. In other words, special effects is, if you're doing a spaceship sequence with a model and you're using a camera, that's special effects. But if you're doing it all on the computer, that's visual effects.
I think another thing, too, another name for the special effects is also, people refer to it as practical effects a lot, because it's just right there happening on set.
Right, and for us, I mean, Jen is much younger than I am, so Jen has grown up in the visual effects era, while I grew up in the special effects era. And I was right there for Star Wars, which was pretty much all physical special effects. It wasn't until the prequels that it all became proudly, George Lucas proudly made that all digital and mostly visual effects. And so to make an action scene now, especially in a movie like Captain America: Civil War, because the moment Iron Man puts on his suit, he is, for maybe a couple of minutes, a stuntman in a suit. But for the most part, he is a totally animated, computer-generated visual effect. So, and he is fighting, one of the best fights in Captain America: Civil War is the climactic fight between Iron Man, Captain America, and the Winter Soldier, where their Winter Soldier and Captain America are trading off, finding out clever ways to stop something that normally you wouldn't think that even enhanced human beings could stop, which is a robot, basically, a man inside a metal machine. And so that's a fascinating, for people who just like action, like me, that's a fascinating scene, but also for people who love film and filmmaking the way I do, it takes on an extra dimension, which is why I don't care really about the plot unless the plot is unsatisfying and doesn't work, because I'm watching the movie being made and I'm watching them make these decisions that will make the movie either interesting or really exciting and thrilling. So in the case of a Captain America: Civil War, oh my, I mean, trying to attribute the fights to just a couple of individuals is very difficult, because on a movie like Captain America: Civil War, which was filmed in several countries, usually in the case of, for instance, James Bond movies, and we will be doing several episodes on James Bond in the near future or in the future, they will have the second unit will usually take care of the action. The main director is taking care of the drama and the other sequences, but the actual huge battle scenes are done by the second unit people. And in the case of Captain America: Civil War, you had second unit directors in Germany and Puerto Rico, as well as a platoon of second unit directors in the United States. Now, for Captain America, Sam Hargrave is credited as fight and stunt coordinator, as well as a guy named Mickey Giacomazzi. And Mickey, if I spelled your, if I pronounce your name wrong, I apologize. Please send me a text or an email or ask to be on the show to correct the pronunciation. Meanwhile, I was fascinated. If you look at the credits of Captain America Civil War, which will take you 10 minutes to read through, Robert Downey Jr. had his own two fight choreographers. Not one fight choreographer, two of them. Eric Oram and James Young. Everyone else had to deal with Sam Hargrave and Mickey, but Robert Downey had his own guys. And then, as I think if you remember the history of Captain America Civil War, everybody was up in arms and frightened. Oh my gosh, they'd had to go back for reshoots. It's going to be a terrible movie. But the reshoots, at least one of the reshoots, was about the Black Panther sequences, which is another one of those characters who becomes a stuntman, but then when they're fighting on the highway, becomes a digital effect. And a guy named Aaron Tony, or Tony, whatever, it's spelled T as in Thomas, O, N as in Nancy, E, Y. Aaron Tony is credited as the fight choreographer for the reshoots. So that is quite an amazing team. And for me, that was the best movie of the summer in terms of action, because it has what I look for in action scenes, which is a differentiation. My ongoing complaint about action scenes today is that they're very generic. Everyone fights the same way. I was brought up, I discovered Kung Fu movies with Jackie Chan's Drunken Master, and there everyone fought individually with individual styles. They not only fought using, in the case of Drunken Master, Jackie used a monkey style Kung Fu and then drunken monkey style, but he also fought the way Jackie fought. And so suddenly you understand the character through how they're fighting. Jackie used everything in the room, and that he created his character that was unmistakable and totally different from any other fighter in the movie. That allowed you to get to know the character, not just as a person in a movie, but as a fighter. So when he's faced, when the monkey is facing a tiger-style fighter who is already shown earlier in the film to be savage and mean and nasty, and you know Jackie's not. Jackie's trying not to fight throughout the whole thing. Suddenly, when the tiger guy faces the monkey guy, I in the audience goes, oh, this is going to be great. So that's one of the barometers I use to judge modern action films. And for the most part, in modern action films, I don't do that. I just sit there and go, okay, here comes another waste of time. Here's another, what I call empty movement. People just swinging and kicking and just doing stuff without any distinction. That did not happen in Captain America Civil War because although they don't have Kung Fu styles, they have specific powers. Each of these characters has a different power. Captain America is an enhanced human. You know what Iron Man can do. And the truly astonishing thing about Captain America Civil War from an action standpoint is that at the climactic sequence, which is the fight at the airport between Team Cap and Team Iron Man, there were, Mike, do you remember how many guys fighting each other?
I was going to say a dozen.
Yeah, there are five on each side, but maybe six that would add on. And normally you would think a fight like that, a fight, in fact, in a film that we will be talking about relatively soon that also came out this summer, we had a huge group of superheroes who were totally indistinct from each other. There was nothing they did that made them them. But in Captain America Civil War, the Russos and their team, in order to make fight scenes like this, you have to plan way ahead. You have to plan it out to the millisecond because you're dealing with visual effects and special effects and stuntmen and actors and everything, set designers, everything. So they knew what they were going to do, and they did it. And they were able to make each fighter distinct, not to the degree of Jackie Chan and Drunken Master, but enough that I set up. And I could not wait to see what Black Panther would do with Spider-Man and what Iron Man would do with Falcon and what Winter Soldier would do. Who else am I missing? There were so many guys in there. And there was also what worked for me is I have been a comic reader since I was a little child. I started with Superman and Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane and and all that. And I was in my formative years when Marvel appeared, the Marvel comics appeared. So I started Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, Daredevil, X-Men from issue one, the Hulk, everything from issue one. So I had a vested interest in this film because I knew these characters. And for me, the greatest moment of the summer from an action standpoint was when Ant-Man became Giant-Man. And he becomes gigantic. And I was literally thrilled. I have to say, during this podcast, I talk about another moment that thrilled me. I don't think there was another moment as thrilling for me as that moment in Captain America: Civil War. It also, another thing they did, which a lot of movies don't, which I think is very important to make action movies exciting, is they connected the action to the emotions and the motivations of the characters. Oftentimes in movies, people will fight just because they do, just because in the script. And this literally happens. Oftentimes, scripts are written where the writer doesn't know anything about action scenes, so they'll write action scene, and then they'll hand it over to the second unit. And the second unit will take care of it. Here, they obviously didn't do that. Everyone had a motivation. Everyone had a reason for why they were fighting. And that was another exciting thing about that airport fight. Team Cap's job was to get to the plane so they could escape. Team Iron Man's job was to stop them. So, and some of them were conflicted. Let me see if I can say that properly. Some of them were conflicted about what they were doing, had different motivations. So that added to the emotion of the scene when people would change sides and they would do things. And also, unlike that other movie, which we will get to, or I will get to, because as usual, I'm monologuing now, I'm making a speech. Marvel was extremely smart in introducing each of their characters in their own movies over a period of years. They just didn't take a handful of guys you don't know anything about and hurl them onto the screen at the same time. Here we had a past with Iron Man. We had a past with Captain America. We even had a past with Spider-Man, even if you don't know the politics that went into getting Spider-Man into this movie, because the rights for Spider-Man were bought by another studio who were bogarting the character. If you know what that phrase means, they were holding on to the character, but Marvel made a deal, so they're able to put. And Marvel is better than anybody else at this point about getting good writers, getting good actors, not just stars, but good actors who are right for the roles, getting good directors and letting their directors work without interference. We'll get into more of that stuff later. Now, Mike, you are a huge comic book fan.
Yes.
What were your feelings on Captain America in general, and maybe the action specifically?
I thought it was great. I really enjoyed the action sequences. But I'll tell you what I really also enjoyed was those iconic moments, which they knew what to do. When Captain America and Iron Man run toward each other and they freeze frame it, they knew that was a fanboy moment. And they did that. If you'll notice, somebody at Warner's was paying attention to that because there was a similar sequence in Suicide Squad.
Hey, we weren't going to mention that.
With Joker and Harley Quinn.
Yes.
So that is something, and it's more than likely going to be something you're going to see in all these movies, because that's the one thing that people who try to figure out what the system is and why Marvel is successful will look at that and say, hey, that must be it, because they do these little iconic moments. And so you're going to see these little freeze frame comic book cover moments in a lot of films. But Captain America was one of the first to do it, and I liked it. And down the road, I'll probably hate it.
Okay, well, now that you said the secret word SS, what seems to be happening with the DC and Marvel people is that the DC Warner Brothers people will see the success of the Marvel movies and then just borrow from it rather than having to.
Really? Don't you think Geoff Johns is going to be smarter than that?
We'll see. But so far, Geoff Johns has only been given power lately. Before it was
for everything that comes out after now.
After Suicide Squad.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's hope. But we're not talking about after. We're talking about before. And what they've been doing before, apparently, during what I call the Zatoff period, is they've been seeing how well the Marvel does and then goes, well, it must be because we have a dark tone and they have a light tone. It has nothing to do with that. But even so, DC will say, oh, they have some funny moments in Captain America, so we'll wedge some into Suicide Squad. We'll do some reshoots. But we haven't. But we're getting to Suicide Squad later. Let's stay on Captain America Civil War first, May 6th. Jen, did you see that?
I did.
And what did you think?
I loved it.
Why?
It had such a... I don't know, for me it was... I liked it more than I liked the both the Avengers films. I've always liked the Captain America films the most, just because that's one of the characters. I grew up more on the DC side, mm-hmm. and with Marvel it was more X-Men and Spider-Man through my brother. But Captain America was... I really liked the original film because my dad's a big like military history buff, so I gravitated towards that one. And they've just consistently been the stronger films. Just because they kind of... For me, well, like, the second Captain America film was more of, like, a genre breaker, where it was more like a spy thriller film than, it, like, not, I mean, obviously it was an action film, too, mm-hmm. but it wasn't, like, a superhero film. Mm-hmm. And, like, this one kind of felt that way, too. And what I really liked about this one was that it was able to handle all of those characters, like you said, in an interesting, non-generic way. And it was its own standalone film, but it's still obviously tied together the previous films and helped set up the future films. And I like that. Like, sometimes you can tell when they're just, like, setting a film up to for the next film.
Right.
And that's so irritating, but this is just, like, you just enjoy this one.
Yeah, you look forward to the next one because they set it up so well.
Yeah.
You brought up a good point, and I'm going to make a suggestion that probably one of the reasons that the Captain America films, I think in general from what I've seen of the reaction, are more appreciated than the other films is because the Captain America character has been created beautifully. The first movie set him up as a sympathetic, empathetic character. Mm-hmm. That little guy who just keeps trying. And he wasn't always this muscle-bound guy. Inside that muscle-bound guy is a very sweet, smart, kind man. And I think everyone gravitates to that. No matter how great Robert Downey Jr. is as Tony Stark. Tony Stark, which has been made clear by the Age of Ultron, is a selfish, stupid man. He's just a terrible guy. And while Captain America is just a great guy. And so you know where they're both coming from, which is more than you can say. And you made it also a very good point, which introduces us to the next movie in the wrap-up. May 27th it came out. It is called X-Men Apocalypse. Directed by Bryan Singer, with fight choreography by Walter Garcia, who also did Ant-Man, who did some... And it's really interesting to see X-Men Apocalypse and compare it to Ant-Man from an action standpoint, because even though you can say, well, those are both Marvel characters, yes, but only one of those movies was made by Marvel Entertainment. X-Men Apocalypse was made, I believe, by 20th Century Fox, who has the rights to X-Men and are holding on to them so Marvel can't have them back. So you look at the action in Ant-Man, the fight between Ant-Man and Falcon, and the fight at the end in the wonderful sequence with the miniature train set that becomes a much larger train set, among other things. And you compare it to the fights in X-Men Apocalypse. Did you see X-Men Apocalypse, Jen?
Yes.
Did you? You saw it, Mike,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, here's the situation. Captain America Civil War is how you do a movie with a lot of superheroic characters. After seeing X-Men Apocalypse, I admired Captain America Civil War even more because they took more than a dozen protagonists and they gave them each distinct moments and you know who everyone was. I can only remember one action scene in X-Men Apocalypse. And can you guess which one that was? Because the Days of Future Past had the same issue. And this is something that's very important as we go on with the action film autopsy, and I discuss how to make an involving action scene. One of the problems, especially on television, of creating involving action scenes is the moment you create a character who knows what they're doing, who fights in a way that's unique to them, you will not take your eyes off that person. Bruce Lee was a great example in The Green Hornet. Once he started doing kung fu, myself, I will speak for myself, but I also have heard from many others, nobody looked at anyone else on that show. Even Van Williams said, make it about Bruce. Because once somebody starts fighting smart, once somebody tries to prove how smart they are, as opposed to how tough they are, then all eyes will go to that person and they want to see how they solve the same problem in a smart way rather than a tough way. And what happened with X-Men, Days of Future Past, and X-Men Apocalypse is the only person I remember is Evan Peters as Quicksilver. The Quicksilver sequences, especially in Days of Future Past, was what is known in the business as a showstopper. Once that scene happened, which I believe was around the middle of the film, the rest of the film didn't really matter. And that was also especially true of X-Men Apocalypse, which had a fairly ludicrous villainous character who was so powerful there really wasn't anything to do with him. And he was also cast in a way that diminished him. The actor, Oscar Isaac, who's really good in the new Star Wars movie, it doesn't really read here. They cover him in makeup, and he's not a man of large stature. So the idea of getting a great actor who they would put under that costume and under all that makeup, and they would digitalize his voice so it would be different, doesn't really make a lot of sense. For all the good of casting Oscar Isaac, they might as well have done it visual effects-wise. They might as well have done it motion capture, which they essentially did. But he's not memorable. And other than Quicksilver saving everybody at the Xavier School from an explosion, amidst the explosion, I cannot remember a single fight moment from that movie. Can either of you?
I mean, growing up, I really liked Jean Grey. So for me, the Phoenix part at the end was, I'm not saying that I agreed with it, but I...
No, I remember it now that you mentioned it.
Yeah, but I'm kind of like, I wasn't sure how they were going to end it. Because for me, it was funny because I felt like the old X-Men Evolution cartoon handled the Apocalypse villain better than this film did.
Oh, I agree.
And I kept thinking in the movie, like, not trying to get ahead of the film while I was watching it, but I remember actively being like, how are they going to, like, end this film? Because in that show, they used a character Leech and they used Rogue, but in this film, like, they had already had, they introduced the character Leech in the second X-Men film, or the third one. Where it's just like, oh, they already introduced these characters and they, like, already kind of had their plot points in this whole series.
It's a very good point. I grew up with the original X-Men, and when I went off to college, I had the first 50 issues of virtually every Marvel comic. When I came back for a vacation, I found out my mom had thrown them away. And then I went to work in comic books in the 70s, and that really screwed my head up. So I stopped reading comic books. So let me ask you and Mike, with Captain America Civil War, even if you didn't know these Marvel characters specifically, they did a very good job of introducing them. I was watching X-Men Apocalypse, and I'm going, now who's that? And then when Jean Grey did do that thing at the end, I went, oh, that's who that is. But up till then, I really was a little confused about who these people were and more specifically, what their powers were. Except, of course, for Cyclops, you know, that's pretty obvious. How did you feel about that? Did you feel that was as muddy as I thought it was?
Well, basically, I think what you got to do is you have to consider the fact that Marvel movies have had a big warm-up here.
Yeah.
I mean, there were 3 Iron Man movies, 2 Captain America movies, 2 Avengers movies. What am I missing?
And Thor. But remember,
so you had all those things to establish your characters.
Right.
X-Men had the group of original movies, of which there were 3. Mm-hmm. Then they rebooted them with X-Men First Class. So the characters were different, but not really. But they were different actors. But they were kind of twisted a little bit differently. Yeah. So they've been stop, start.
Yeah, I don't think you needed...
The warm-up act was bigger, is my point.
Yeah, you didn't need to have a lot of knowledge to enjoy Captain America Civil War, but I think to enjoy it as much as you could enjoy it, you needed a lot of knowledge about the X-Men to enjoy X-Men Apocalypse.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's also interesting, too, because thinking about it and thinking about what you said about Captain America Civil War, like, I guess some of the earlier, like, superhero films, like, contemporary ones, or I guess, I don't know, like, for me... Like, obviously there's, like, Blade. But I guess, was the X-Men film, was that really the first ensemble superhero film? Because before that, it was just, like, the Batman films and, you know.
I think it was.
Because I'm saying, for me as a kid, like, I went to see that. I remember my mom took it. She didn't even know it was live action. So she thought she was sitting through, like, an hour and a half cartoon. And she was, like, you know, begrudgingly. And then it was, like, the opening, you know, the scene at the concentration camp happened, and she was just like, this is live action? And like, we were like, yeah, and like that, I think that elevated it for her too.
Well, that was clearly the best of the X-Men.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Although, but, people,
like,
will quibble.
I remember, for me, it was so cool to see, like, all of these characters and all of these Easter eggs and things. So I think it's hard for me to separate out this film. Like, yeah. You know, because for me, it's like, as a fan of the characters, I'm just like, oh, you know, this character didn't really, like, Storm, you know, has, like, three lines of dialogue in this film. But it's like, oh, but it's Storm. Like, you know, she's such a badass. And, like, she's married to Black Panther, which, like, is like a fun little Easter egg that's never going to happen because they're owned by different
people.
Because
different studios own the rights to different things. But now that you're mentioning it, I do remember the tragic scene with Magneto killing everybody who killed his family. Oh, spoiler alert! Anyway, I do remember that scene now. But for the most part, it was muddy. And I also, the thing that made me laugh the most was when Oscar Isaac, as Apocalypse, gave... why am I blanking on her name? She was on Attack of the Show. She plays... who does she play in this? She wears...
You mean Olivia.
Olivia Munn.
Yes.
What's her name? What's her character's name in this? You remember?
Well, Psylocke.
Psylocke, right.
Yeah.
When Psylocke suddenly gets her costume, and it's like, where did that costume come from? It was kind of... There's a certain kind of person in the world, and there's a term, and I will probably put this in the wraparound or on the supplemental material for this podcast, of a person who has a certain interest in Asian women. And they, you know, they dress them kawaii or whatever, but there's a very specific term. It is so widespread that the Japanese have a term for it. And I could have sworn that's exactly what Apocalypse was. Apocalypse took one look at Olivia Munn's character and said, I'm giving her this costume. And we go, oh, you nasty, nasty man. You foolish boy. It came out of nowhere for me and made me laugh in the theater. But all in all, X-Men Apocalypse is a way not to juggle a bunch of Marvel superheroes. We'll get to that other one that doesn't juggle DC superheroes very well, or supervillains. Captain America remains. But to segue from what you said, Jen, about your mom reacting to the original X-Men, saying, this isn't a cartoon. Now we jump to June 3rd, and coming out that day, speaking of comic book, is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows. Ah, okay. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I did not see that movie when it came out. I was very well connected with the very first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles live-action film, which was directed by Steve Barron. I was so close to the crew at that point that they invited me to the crew screening in New York, and I was with them all, watched for the first time, the entire stunt crew, the entire stunt men crew inside the suits. And Steve Barron, who is a greatly underrated director, did a wonderful job with the first one. It's still my favorite. And so when I saw the Michael Bay steroid Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles just in the previews of the original reboot, which was a year or so ago or more, I said, no, I'm not willingly going to Out of the Shadows. So we caught up with it today just before recording this, and I was not wrong in my estimation. Interestingly, this is not directed by Michael Bay. Out of the Shadows is not directed by Michael Bay, but it's directed by a guy I call Poor Dave Green. Dave Green is someone who's worked on shorts. I'll give you more of his credits in the supplemental material, which will be on the website adjoining this. But he stuck with this thing to do it in the Michael Bay style. And I was fascinated by this movie, not happily fascinated, but fascinated in that I've always felt, I wrote the Ninja Master book series for Warner Books. I wrote 12 Ninja Master books, and the last 8 were 2 tetralogies, which still set the record for the most books I've ever had sold. I think it either published or sold 500,000 copies of the last 8, which were 2 tetralogies called Year of the Ninja Master, War of the Ninja Master. In short, I've done a lot of research on ninja, and I think ninja are ridiculous, and they're stupid. I always say stupid ninja, because they were pathetic creatures in reality. In reality, they had no place on earth and none in heaven. That's what made them so interesting to me, and I think many people subconsciously, in that they did the dishonorable things that the samurai couldn't do. So even the samurai were the ones who were using a loophole in their code of honor in order to hire ninja, who they spit upon in real life, to do their dirty work. So even the ninja who hired them hated them. They hated themselves. So they were fascinating, fascinating characters. Meanwhile, you, Michael, I believe, knew the creators of the original comic Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Which had nothing to do with this movie.
No, but...
at all.
But say a little bit about... It's Kevin Laird, right?
It's Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird that began this process, but they did it as a parody book for the X-Men at the time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. The X-Men were teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
The X-Men were mutants. And they threw the Turtles thing in for a twist, and there you go. It was done as a parody book.
Yeah, it was a parody book, but it wasn't funny. It was done straight. It was done seriously, wasn't it?
It was done.
It wasn't cheap jokes in it.
No, it wasn't an Archie book or a Donald Duck comic. No, but there was humor. There was a certain amount of humor.
Yeah, you have to go back and look at that and see what they.
But a lot more when they were optioned for a television series.
Yeah.
Then the humor became in, and they had to bring it down to a level for younger viewers.
Because their comics they wrote for themselves, basically. Right. They weren't writing for kids.
And then there was a series Archie did. Speaking of Archie, of the Turtles, which was a comic series, which was based on the TV. Mm-hmm. So kind of like almost ate its own tail. Kind of went around.
Right. So it's fairly clear that Eastman and Laird didn't know ninja. They didn't know martial arts.
No, they didn't come into this because they were huge fans of that. They came into this to do a comic they had an idea for. And, you know, I don't think they had any idea along the way that was ever going to be what it was.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. But the thing, now that we're getting, let's get back to the name of this podcast. My problem all along with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and every incarnation is that nobody seems to have any idea what ninja are and what those weapons these guys are carrying. And so to jump into this specific film, I love creating drinking games, even though I don't drink. I love creating drinking games out of movies. And if you take a drink, every time they set up a fight scene in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows, and then don't fight, you will be in the hospital by the end of the film. Because I was absolutely, I kept rewinding and rewatching. They set up specifically for the Ninja Turtle. Other characters would have fights. They were very rudimentary fights. The standard mixed martial arts, WWE wrestling style fights. But when the Turtles go into action, I'm expecting one has a sai, one has swords. What are the one I think has? I forgot which one. Again, we'll
nunchucks.
Which
staff.
Yeah, nunchucks. By the way, isn't a ninja weapon. Bow staff. It's they have these weapons. They never use them correctly. They never use them the way they're supposed to be used.
That's what always bugged me growing up.
Yeah. It's not important that they do. What's important is that they use them in a way that makes them more than just props. In other words, if you can replace them with anything else, then what's the point of having them? But, of course, they're taking it from the comic book, and that's why they have them. I understand that. But in order to make it involving, exciting, here's the basic law of the action film autopsy. If the fight is not exciting, it's probably not good. Now, there are good fights. We'll get into things like Into the Badlands, which has really good fighting, but not great, because it doesn't have the extra dimensions. There's some really nice choreography, and these people obviously know what they're doing. But they don't go further than that. They just make things look cool. I hear this again and again and again from action choreographers and action directors when I talk to them at the Comic-Con or whatever. They always say, all we were told to do was to make it look cool. And so then you will have a wonderful, time-filling, empty movement sequence where people are just being colorful and moving around. But that's not involving, that's not exciting, that's not interesting, that's not emotionally connecting. So Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles takes that one further out of the shadows by setting up the fights and then not doing them, not finding reasons not to have them fight. They get interrupted, and I think in two cases in this movie, they get interrupted. And in one case, they cut to outside the plane. They're about to have a huge fight on the plane, And they cut to the outside of the plane, and the enemy ninja go flying out of the plane. You don't see how they get out of the plane. You don't see how they're defeated. But I was making a joke at the time of watching this, that because the Ninja Turtles are no longer men in suits, they're motion capture people, or they're completely visual affected, they're completely computer animated people, they also look like they're on steroids. They might as well not be turtles because they're as big as steroid wrestlers. So it doesn't make any point for them to be turtles or to have the weapons, and they certainly don't fight in the movie at all. But the joke I was making was that probably the reason they don't show the fights is that the people who are playing the villains are probably the same people who are doing the motion capture of the heroes. So they couldn't find a way to have them fight each other in an effective manner. So they just cut away from the fights. They just eliminate the fights. So, yeah, okay. By the way,
I disagree with you.
Okay, go ahead.
I disagree with you. I think there's another reason.
Okay.
If you go back to 2003, 2004, when it was when the first Turtle movie, the first of the mm-hmm. reboot Turtle movies came out. And Jen, you probably know more than I do about that, what year that was, somewhere in there, right?
Yeah, I don't even remember.
But there was a big controversy because that movie was darker. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of violence in it. Mm-hmm. And parents went to see it and went, much like Jen's mom did, didn't know what they were getting into when they got in there, didn't like it. There was all sorts of stuff online about it, whatever. I think what they did was, and not rightly so, but I think what they did was they tried to find a happy medium between, here are the turtles, it's dark, but we're not going to show as much violence. That way we'll be able to placate those people, and we'll get it to that particular
thing. Yeah, so you're not
I think it was that
them,
reason.
Just adding another reason.
Yeah, I think it was that reason. I don't think it was anything to do with the suits or
however, other people got fights. Whenever Stephen Amell had a fight scene, he got the fight. He had several fight scenes, and they didn't cut away from him because nobody was doubling him. So you may be right, but I'm also right, or neither of us are right. But what I want is for John Valera, who is credited as the fight coordinator in this movie, to get in touch with me, come on the podcast, or just tell me in an email to, go spin on it, buddy, because he's getting a lot of work. He worked on The Wolverine, he worked on John Wick, and by the way, John Wick was essentially the movie that inspired this podcast, and we're going to do a whole episode on John Wick, and I would love for Mr. Valera to get in touch with me, because he's also doing The Return of Xander Cage, the Vin Diesel XXX movie, and Thor Ragnarok as fight coordinator. So I'm most interested in hearing his theory of these fights and how he creates the fight scenes. And I'm asking you, begging you, John, not just to make them look cool, and we'll see what happens. But then, meanwhile, on June 10th, just 1 week later, out came Warcraft. And that's another movie none of us have seen. Except...
I still haven't because I was playing games on my phone when you watched it.
That's right.
And Jen was on the computer looking at Asian porn. And
She was looking for the wallpaper for her website, which will be ready by the time
that's
you
called
this.
A theme, Grandpa.
Theme. That's right.
I was like, oh, God.
There's your wallpaper on the computer you got
so,
there.
So I watched Warcraft. However... From what our discussions while you were on the phone and she was looking at themes and I was watching Warcraft, what we did discuss was that everybody saw the preview, the coming attraction trailer for Warcraft. So tell me what you thought about that, Jen.
As a person who is in the CG animation industry, I always, always love Blizzard, the cinematics for the games and for like the Warcraft expansions. And this was not as good as the cinematics for the game. Obviously it was better than the actual in-game graphics, but I kind of was upset because Legendary Pictures is such a great studio and it just felt like one of those kind of generic CG films and like that sucked because I feel like video game movies just haven't had like their breakthrough moment, like their breakthrough film yet. And I wanted it to be this one. And it was just unappealing to me.
And so did I, because this is directed by Duncan Jones. Duncan Jones is David Bowie's son, who did a wonderful movie, one of my favorite science fiction movies called Moon. So when I heard that he was doing this, and I also heard that he loved Warcraft, I thought they had a great shot at this. Mike, you saw the preview, right?
Right.
And what was your reaction to the trailer?
No excitement at all.
Can you analyze why not?
I had no interest in the product. I had no interest in what it was. But you know something maybe people don't realize, just because something is cool in one medium doesn't necessarily mean it transfers over enough to be cool in another medium. A game that is usually popular with millions of people playing and really great graphics, all of which I will certainly give to the folks at Blizzard, maybe it isn't really something that translates into a movie. Not everything makes a good movie or even a movie, period.
They haven't broken the back of that particular translation. I believe a good movie can be made of everything, but I always use as an example what Rob Reiner did with Stephen King books when he made the movies from Misery and Stand By Me. In that what you need to do to make an effective movie is you have to make it a movie, which means you decide what the book is about and you tell that story in cinematic terms, which is, I've worked in every medium except video games. So I'm always fascinated about adaptation. I've done movie tie-ins and all sorts of things like that. And so I always like to take the medium apart. I like to take the form apart to find out how to put it back together again to make it better or to make it work. And in a movie, it's the difference. Adapting comic books to movies is difficult because comic books don't move. They're still in images while a movie is flowing. And I've worked on books where somebody from television is trying to write a book, and they seem like fictionalized scripts that needs an art director and a set designer to come in. They don't, and I've seen that with several comic book writers who have written novels. I'm thinking of John Byrne as example, and they just like a when you get a sitcom actor and you put him in a movie, if he stalks in the same rhythm, if Matthew Perry talks in the same rhythm in the movie as he does in Friends, I think the movie audience just immediately starts to reject him. And in the case of Warcraft, Jen, you mentioned that what would you say, the images were better in the movie than they were in the video game? What was the term you used?
Well, the effects, like the CG in the film, were better than the in-game graphics.
Were they, though? That's what I was going to say. Were they? Because even though they are better from a, I don't know, detail standpoint,
mm-hmm.
they're off-putting. All the characters look like they're not dry yet. That they've
no, been, I definitely get what you mean.
Yeah, they've been processed. They're all wet-looking. And the biggest mistake in this movie that I could not get beyond, and I'm assuming many other people in the audience couldn't get beyond, is the look of the non-human characters have these huge tusks, yet they are speaking English. And I defy anyone, I would like you to do a YouTube movie for me, putting in your mouth tusks the size that they had in Warcraft, and say and give me the Gettysburg Address in such a way I can understand what you're saying. There was just a unnaturalness about the whole movie that did not read to me and was not acceptable to me and was off-putting to me. But enough of that. Let's get.
Well, wait one second. Hold on. But Jen, you can tell me if I'm wrong about this. But that particular look is very essential to the game itself. Those are familiar characters, and if they would have changed that, it would have changed this.
Yes.
It wouldn't have been Warcraft. It would have been something else.
I'm glad.
And there's a whole other.
Yeah.
I'm glad you
slippery
brought that up.
Slope.
I was not going to suggest that they changed the look. I am, and was, and will suggest they changed the language. In other words, Lord of the Rings.
Were they supposed to subtitle it?
Absolutely, Lord of the Rings did. Or find a way, or do something which was brilliant. If you've never seen Judgment at Nuremberg, I highly recommend you see it. It's a wonderful movie anyway. But there's a moment where Judgment at Nuremberg is about the real trials of the Nazis after World War II. And so at the trial, we have a lot of translation issues. And what Stanley Kramer did brilliantly was to start the movie with Spencer Tracy speaking English and Maximilian Schell speaking German. And then at a moment in the film, in the middle of a sentence, he does something which shows you clearly that we're going to do a movie magic now, and we're going to change the way they talk so you understand what they're saying and you don't have to read subtitles throughout. They should have known that there was an issue with this movie in terms of accepting the look of these characters and find a way around it without changing it, but not necessarily having them speak English-accented English in a way that it would be acceptable. They had to get, again, don't show me how tough you are, show me how smart you are.
I think that's kind of like a fundamental problem with the film, though, because mm-hmm. it seemed like I feel like they couldn't go too deep into how nerdy it was, because I feel like World of Warcraft is a very... I know I'm saying that.
I was thinking, the reason she was reacting is that I was acting like, what, are you insane? Only nerds are going to see this movie.
But that's what I'm saying, though, where it's like, World of Warcraft is a very polarizing game to some people where, like, for, I guess, like, less nerdy people, you know, you find out somebody plays that and you assume they're kind of a basement-dwelling person with no social life. And obviously that's not true.
That's totally true.
I hate that type of stereotype. But it seemed like this movie had a problem with, like, who they wanted to cater it to, where it's like they didn't want it to... Like, I heard that there were, like, in-jokes for players... But, you know, they didn't want it to be so polarizing and isolating that other people wouldn't go see it, which I think was a big part of the problem. So they tried to make it just kind of a fantasy film, and then it just kind of got watered down and just kind of didn't meet either group.
That's an interesting point of view, because what often happens, and we will get into it when we get to the secret SS film, is that there's often a war between the producers / studio and director / writer. And the director-writer usually wants to do what's best for the film, while the studio, which is not always as creative as it should be, decides that we're going to cater to the lowest common denominator. And that's maybe what happened here. But because Duncan Jones loved Warcraft and did not want to water it down, but the studio was going... But I always want to tell the studio very clearly, who do you think is going to see this the first weekend? It's not going to be the wide audience. It will only get to the wide audience if the opening weekend's audience goes to them and says, gives them the thumbs up, says it's okay. It's going to be the comic book nerds who see the comic book movie first and tell the rest of the world, yes, it's good, go see it, which is a great example of what happened with BVS, Batman versus Superman, that not enough of those people went out and said it was good. They actually, more than half of them, majority of them, it's safe to say, said, no, it sucks, don't see it. So studios, please, don't water it down because you're killing your chances of succeeding. You need to have it 100% so the fans, who's going to see a movie called Warcraft? Warcraft fans. And if they don't like it, not many other people are going to see it. But let me get back to the action film autopsy aspect. The fight coordinator, understand that there are fight directors, fight choreographers, fight choreographers, oh my goodness, and fight coordinators. Buster Reeves, who was the stunt double for Tom Hardy in The Dark Knight Rises, was the fight coordinator for Warcraft. But, and this was one of the few times he's been credited as a fight arranger. Mostly he does stunt work, which is a completely different kettle of fish. And what often happens, and I'm not saying this happened with you, Mr. Reeves, but what often happens, I found, from speaking to a lot of people, is that when you are promoted from the stunt crew to the fight coordinator, you do what you're most comfortable with and what everybody's most comfortable with. It's probably not a good idea to start making demands that we do this different, because then, oh, who are you? You're coming out of nowhere telling us what to do. Forget it. It's very unlikely that happens. So actually, yes, the fighting in Warcraft is very Warcraftian. Here is a movie that is clearly just crammed filled with visual effects and stunt people and computer animation. So, yes, he probably took the lesser road or the easier road, and I certainly don't blame him for that. But the result was not in any way memorable.
Well, thank the cinema gods that's over, huh? I do prattle on, don't I? So much, in fact, that we felt the need to split this summer wrap-up into two parts. So stay tuned. In 2 weeks, we'll post the second part of the summer wrap-up with film autopsy reports on Legend of Tarzan, Star Trek Beyond, Jason Bourne, Mechanic Resurrection, and even Ghostbusters and Kubo and the Two Strings. Yay! Wait a minute. Am I forgetting something? Oh, yeah. Also, Suicide Squad. But until then, here's a few immediate cleanups on aisle autopsy. Please pardon the dings and jangles you hear on the recording. One is Mike's Apple Watch alerting him to various things, and the other comes from the collar of Mike's wonderful dog, Kara. Also, please excuse the different volumes in our voices. Jen and I were using one mic, while Mike had his own mic. Now, the X-Men Apocalypse Studio is indeed 20th Century Fox, who bought X-Men rights many moons ago, and in order to keep them, must keep making X-Men movies like clockwork. By the way, the inclusion of the X-Men's Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch in Avengers Age of Ultron is not because of a deal between Fox and Marvel. It's because Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch were mutants first and Avengers second, meaning that both studios own the film rights to the characters and can use them as long as Marvel doesn't mention the word mutants, which Fox owns, and Fox doesn't mention the words the Avengers, which Marvel owns. This led to the confusing situation where two different versions of the same characters appeared in two unrelated films, Marvel's Avengers Age of Ultron and Fox's X-Men Days of Future Past. That's also one of the reasons why Ultron killed Quicksilver. Now, you might have noticed that I mentioned Van Williams as one of the people who appreciated Bruce Lee as Kato on the Green Hornet TV series. Van Williams was the Green Hornet on that TV series and told me that he suggested that the producers make them equal co-stars, but sadly that was not to be. And after the Christopher Reeve Superman and Tim Burton Batman movies, the first major modern superhero movie of the 21st century was indeed X-Men in the year 2000, although Blade came out in 1998. By the way, I still don't have the exact term that I was thinking of or trying to recall that I was going to call Apocalypse for his deciding to suddenly dress Psylocke the way he does. The Japanese word that means a foreigner who has a particular interest in Japanese women could be charai or tsukiba, but I'm pretty sure those aren't the words I'm looking for, but I'll keep looking. Now, the Michael Bay reboot of the steroided Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out in 2014, the only other feature film that Dave Green directed before Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows was a 2014 ripoff called Earth to Echo. For the rest, check the supplemental posting elsewhere on the Action Film Autopsy website. Hope to hear that you're here, hearing the next episode of Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy in 2 weeks. Until then, remember what I always say. Use your blinkers, jackass!
Okay, break it up, break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more film fun, frenzy, and friends. Until then,
a real fight.
Check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.
Sonic victory.